Good morning, Sound FM listeners, and welcome to part two of a new show on Sound FM called The Great Bharat. Every Sunday from 11:30 to 12:30, after Sargam Radio, we'll be listening to the Mahabharata podcast, which is a retelling of the ancient Indian epic called the Mahabharata by Lawrence Manzo. The podcast is available on iTunes, so be sure to check it out, and also check out the official website, mahabharatapodcast.blogspot.ca. For about 45 minutes of each show, we'll be listening to the podcast, and for the remainder, I'll be giving you my own reactions and commentary on the story. Just to give you some background, I'm not an expert on the Mahabharata by any means, but I am a person of Indian descent who was born in Canada. My parents were born in the British colony of Guyana, and several generations before them, my family lived somewhere in India. I grew up as a Christian and had some exposure to Islam, but no direct contact with Hinduism. The Mahabharata is an entirely new story for me, and one that sheds light on my own heritage. With this show, I intend to share this story with you, who may have little or no knowledge on the subject, yet may have come into contact with Hindu culture and concepts. Yoga, Hare Krishna, karma, reincarnation, what are these things? And where and when did they come from? As I said, this is part two of the show, and it's a weekly show. And for this episode, we're going to listen to episode 6 and 7 of the Mahabharata podcast. As I said, it's available on iTunes. So you can go download it from there to check out other episodes. Last week we did episodes 1 through 5. And we've covered so far the introduction to the story. And we've just introduced one of the main characters, whose name is Bhishma. And as Lawrence Manzo describes, he has a parallel in ancient Greek culture, which is an ancient Greek myth. He has a parallel to Zeus. So it's interesting. We're already seeing some parallels between the story and, say, the ancient Greek myths, which you, with some of our listeners, may be more familiar with. I just like to reiterate that the podcast is not necessarily suitable for all listeners. There are descriptions of sexuality and violence from time to time. So listener discretion is advised. And as always, you can check out a recording of this show if you go to www.soundfm.ca. I will be posting recordings of every show for you to download, and those include the podcast to which we'll be listening, as well as my commentary. And don't forget, you can also tune in online, soundfm.ca/listen. And I'm just going to see if we can skip ahead here. Okay, let's get right into the podcast, and I'll get back at you at the end of the show.
This is the Mahabharata Podcast, Episode 6, No Good Deed Unpunished. Before I get started with this episode, I'd like to say that I'm gratified that this podcast is gaining subscribers. As long as you keep listening, I'll keep making new episodes. I'd love to hear your comments or feedback, so please take a minute and go to my website, www.mahabharatapodcast.com, and leave a comment. Thanks for your support. In the last episode, we met Bhishma and his two brothers, Chitrangada and Vichitravirya. We left off with the death of their father, Santanu, when the two youngest sons were still children. Despite the fact that Bhishma was the eldest son, had the most experience, and was by far the most capable among the three brothers, he had sworn an oath that Satyavati would be mother of the king, and so he placed his brother Chitrangada in line for the throne. Bhishma then took over the post of regent, while his stepmother, Satyavati, supervised. When Chitrangada came of age, he was crowned king and ruled over Hastinapur as a powerful warrior. He must have been the type to go out looking for trouble, because he ended up in an extended duel with the king of the Gandharvas, also named Chitrangada. Gandharvas are a type of nature spirit, perhaps something like an angel, or possibly like the elves in Tolkien's Middle-earth. So you can imagine that it's not easy to kill a Gandharva, let alone a Gandharva king. So, after 3 years of fighting, the Gandharva king was victorious, and the Bharati king, Chitrangada, was dead. Bhishma, of course, could not take up the throne himself, so the young weakling, Vichitravirya, was made king. I'm only guessing he was a weakling, but I think you'll agree as we look at the subsequent events. His mother, Satyavati, consulted with Bhishma, and they decided the boy needed wives. It so happened that in the kingdom of Kashi, modern-day Varanasi, the king's daughters were going to hold a swayamvara, which is a ceremony in which the brides choose their husbands from a group of suitors. Rather than sending the boy Vichitravirya himself and hoping he might get chosen, they decided they would have a better chance going the old-fashioned route, snatch and grab. Bhishma mounted his chariot in full armor and rode to Kashi. When he got there, he headed straight for the three young princesses, pulled them onto his chariot, then gave a brief lecture on Dharma. He listed the 8 forms of marriage, from arranged marriage to elopement to rape, and then declared that abducting a princess was the very best form of marriage for the warrior caste. He then challenged them all to try to stop him, and tore off as fast as his horses could run. Of course, all the young bloods who were lined up for the ceremony immediately stripped off their finery and jumped on their chariots to stop this kidnapping. Even though there were thousands of them in pursuit of one man, that one man was Bhishma, and he was unstoppable. Out of the crowd of attackers, King Salva forced Bhishma to turn and defend himself. Calling him lecher and telling him to stop, Salva fought a few rounds with Bhishma, showering him with arrows. He managed to slow up Bhishma's pace somewhat, but then Bhishma killed Salva's horses and charioteer, thus ending his pursuit. Bhishma arrived in Hastinapur triumphant, with the 3 fiancées for his younger brother. As preparations for the marriage were underway, the eldest girl, named Amba, approached Bhishma. She told him that she had already set her heart on another man, that same King Salva who had nearly stopped Bhishma's escape. She told Bhishma that the two of them had a prior arrangement, and thus it would be unlawful for her to marry anyone else. Considering this, Bhishma consulted with the learned Brahmins, and they concluded that she should be allowed to leave for her betrothed. Please don't forget about Amba. Her story is still far from over, but we'll hear of her more in a later episode. As for the 2 younger princesses, named Ambika and Ambalika, both were married to Vichitravirya. This marriage lasted 7 years, but no child was conceived. Then the king, Vichitravirya, died. This left the Kuru dynasty in a real crisis. Their last living heir of the dynasty was an avowed celibate. Something urgent needed to be done. Satyavati was the matriarch of the dynasty, and therefore in charge of the continuation of the line. Consulting the laws and precedents, she came to a conclusion and instructed Bhishma to impregnate the dead king's 2 wives and thus save the dynasty from extinction. Bhishma's reply was typically passive-aggressive. He said, "Remember when my father wanted so badly to marry you? Remember the oath I swore in order to satisfy your father? Well, that oath of celibacy is the highest law, and I will not violate it." Perhaps Bhishma took some grim satisfaction as Satyavati babbled inconsolably in her hunger for grandsons. He then suggested a solution, but first he had a couple of stories to tell. Bhishma told her about the Brahmin Bhargava named Parasurama, who, in retaliation for his father's murder, angrily killed off the entire race of Kshatriyas, or warrior caste. We are mostly familiar with the Brahmin caste as being occupied with the Vedas and rituals, but there was one group of Brahmins called Bhargavas who took up the occupation of arms. They are said to have quarreled with the Kshatriyas and, in this case, actually killed them all off. The Kshatriya women, bereft of their husbands, turned to the Brahmins and with them repopulated the warrior caste. Just in case you're a little confused about these terms, ancient India divided society into 4 hereditary classes called Varnas. The Brahmins, who functioned as priests, the Kshatriyas, who bore arms and held kingship, Vaishyas, who were the merchant or bourgeois class, and the Shudras, who were peasants or serfs. This is generally referred to as the caste system, and some vestiges of it remain to this day in Hindu society, but it's generally not polite to ask. We'll mostly hear about the Brahmin and Kshatriya Varnas in the Mahabharata, since presumably they would be the only ones literate and wealthy enough to have a story about themselves preserved for this long. Bhishma then told a second story about a wise seer called Uttatya and his wife Mamata. Uttatya's younger brother was a famous Brihaspati, who was the priest to the gods. One time, while alone together, Brihaspati assaulted his sister-in-law. She yelled at him to stop, saying that she was already pregnant with her husband's child, and so for him to spill his seed would be a waste. It's an odd argument to make at a time like this, but I guess these old rishis were very conservative with their semen. In any case, the old boy was too far gone, and he shot off his wad. As this happened, the little fetus spoke up, saying, "Boh! There's no room in here for two. You have wasted your seed, and I was here first." Thus annoyed and ashamed by the cheeky little fetus, Brihaspati cursed it to blindness and suffering. The child, Dirga Thomas, was born blind, but nevertheless grew up into a powerful Brahmin and fathered 4 sons of his own. When he was quite old, the sons decided that the cost of keeping him was not worth it, so they tied him to a log and sent him adrift down the river. As the blind old man floated down the river, he was rescued by a wise king named Balan. Balan happened to be sterile and had no children. He recognized Dirga Thomas's greatness and asked the old man to lie with his wife and beget children. Dirga Thomas agreed, but the wife was unwilling and tried to fool him by putting servant girls in the bed. The old man did his thing with the servants, but also reported the substitution to the king. The king then compelled his wife to do her duty, which she did, and thus the king's dynasty was carried on to the next generation. The point Bhishma was trying to make was that when a line of kings faced the danger of extinction, they should turn to a qualified Brahmin to engender children on the remaining women of the clan. Upon hearing these stories, Satyavati decided to make a confession. She told Bhishma about her old job running the ferry and the randy Brahmin Parasara who assailed her. See episode 3. She explained that she had given birth to a Brahmin named Krishna Dvaipayana Vyasa. She recalled that her son had offered his help if at any time she needed him, and now they could use him to beget children on her 2 widowed daughter-in-laws. Bhishma considered her proposal and decided that this plan was perfectly according with Dharma and in the best interest of the dynasty. With Bhishma's approval, Satyavati meditated on her son, and off in the wilderness, while holding some kind of sadhu seminar on the Vedas, Vyasa heard her call and magically teleported himself to his mother's presence. Satyavati welcomed her son and then made a brief speech to him, worthy of any lawyer. "Sons, O sage, are born the common property of the father and the mother. The mother is no less their owner, to be sure, than the father. Just as you are my firstborn son, Vichitravirya is my lastborn son. Therefore, just as Bhishma is Vichitravirya's brother on the father's side, so you are his brother on the mother's side. This son of Santanu, Bhishma, whose word is his strength, is keeping faith with his word, and has no mind either to have children or to rule the kingdom. Now, out of esteem for your brother, for the continuity of the family, at Bhishma's word and my own behest, out of compassion for the creatures and for the protection of everyone, you must do what I am proposing without any cruelty of heart. The 2 wives of your younger brother, who are like daughters of a god, lovely and in the bloom of their youth, are yearning for sons by the law. Beget children on them that are worthy of our family and of continuing our progeny." It's interesting how Satyavati formed her request in such a precise and formal manner. I think it makes it clear that what she was asking was not really a generally accepted practice. It's as if she were worried that her son might take offense or find a fault in her reasoning. In any event, she need not have worried, because Vyasa was perfectly willing to do his part. He only stipulated that the women observe a vow for a year before he would get started. Satyavati objected to this, saying that a year was far too long to wait, and the dynasty was in trouble, so action was needed right away. Vyasa replied that he would agree to doing the act directly, but that the women should be warned and prepared for his ugliness, bad odor, filthy clothing, and emaciated body. Satyavati then met with her 2 daughters-in-law, Ambika and Ambalika, and convinced them that they should lie with her eldest son. I guess she had a hard enough time convincing them that this act of incest was okay, because she neglected to mention that her oldest son had the hygiene of a week-old roadkill. They started with Ambika, bathed and perfumed her, and left her in bed to await her partner. As she lay there, she imagined it was someone like Bhishma, or perhaps his better-looking older brother, coming to make love to her. Imagine her horror when, without even putting out the lights, this little dreadlock sadhu with skin like moldy beef jerky entered the room and wanted to get it on. The poor girl put up with his advances, but closed her eyes and covered her face until he left the room. I guess even the most otherworldly hobo still has his vanity, because Vyasa was pretty annoyed that the girl was scared of him and had refused to act like she enjoyed it. He announced to Satyavati that she would indeed have her first grandson, that he would be wise, strong, and virtuous, but because Ambika hid her eyes, her son would be blind. His name would be Dhritarashtra. I guess Satyavati didn't learn her lesson that forewarned is forearmed, because she also neglected to warn her second daughter-in-law. So, when Vyasa went to her, she turned pale with fright. Again, Vyasa successfully produced a son, but while this son would have his sight, he would have a sickly pallor. He would be called Pandu the Pale. Following the birth of these two sons, Satyavati called on Ambika to have one more son, just in case something happened to the first two. Ambika agreed, but when the time came for her to lay with that awful man, she lost her nerve and compelled one of her servants to take her place in the bed. This probably points out one of the flaws of the caste system, because this low-class girl did her job the way it should have been done by her betters. She greeted Vyasa with all respect, served him, and pleasured him all night. Vyasa, of course, knew of the deception all along, so the next morning he told her that she would no longer be a slave, and that the child she had conceived would become the most sagacious man in the world. This child was called Vidur, the third brother who, born of a commoner, would not be eligible to be king. After this final act, Vyasa announced that he had fulfilled his commitment and then vanished. Back in episode 4, I mentioned the essay called The Partial Incarnations. In there, we are told that Vidur was a partial incarnation of the god Dharma, thus explaining his total enlightenment with issues concerning law and ethics. It is interesting that in the Mahabharata, they talk of Dharma as not only an idea, meaning law, ethics, righteousness, but it is also known as a god. Remember how this whole story was being recited to King Janamejaya at the snake sacrifice? Well, after hearing about the birth of Vidur, King Janamejaya interrupted Vaisampayana and asked him what the god Dharma could possibly have done to be born the son of a Shudra. Vaisampayana answered him with a story about a Brahmin named Mandavya, who was known as a great ascetic. One of his favorite yoga practices was to stand outside his hut with his hands upraised and observing a vow of silence. One day, while doing this yoga, a group of bandits, in hot pursuit by the king's guards, came across his hut and hid inside along with their plunder. When the guards arrived, they asked the hermit about the bandits. The hermit, of course, refused to move or speak, so the guards searched the hut and found the bandits. They suspected the hermit of being an accomplice, so they also arrested him. When the hermit and the other bandits were brought before the king, they were all summarily sentenced to death by impaling. Justice was swift, and all the accused were immediately impaled, including the Brahmin Mandavya. Mandavya was an accomplished yogi, and so, even though he had a stake driven through his body and was suspended off the ground, he did not die. After several days of this, he caught the attention of the king. The king was immediately contrite and ordered the hermit to be removed from the stake and asked his forgiveness. The hermit forgave the king, but unfortunately, the stake could not be removed. All they could do was cut off the ends, leaving the poor guy to walk around with the stake embedded in him. Fortunately, according to the thinking of the times, such a condition of suffering counted as an austerity, and thus he gained immense spiritual power in return for his suffering. Using these new powers, the miserable Brahmin traveled to the realm of the gods and interrogated Lord Dharma himself. He asked the god, what had he done to deserve such a horrible fate in this life? Dharma replied that when Mandavya was just a child, he had impaled flies with blades of grass, and for that youthful act of violence, he must suffer karmic retribution. Mandavya castigated the Lord Dharma, saying that the sin was small, but the punishment horrific. Furthermore, he was an ignorant child when he had done it. Therefore, he cursed the god, saying that he should be born a man, and the son of a Shudra at that. To top it off, he laid down a new rule for posterity, saying that nothing should be counted a sin if committed before the age of 14 years. Thus, we are only karmically responsible for our actions after we have reached the age of discrimination. This explained how the god Dharma was incarnated as the son of a slave. The childhood years of the three princes was a veritable golden age for the land of the Kurus. The three boys each became learned in law and the Vedas, and trained at arms and government, while their uncle Bhishma acted as regent and protector of the nation. Finally, as the boys reached manhood, the second brother, Pandu, was made king. The eldest, Dhritarashtra, was disqualified because of his blindness, and Vidur was disqualified because of his birth. So, once again, just as Devapi was passed over to make his younger brother Santanu king, and Bhishma was passed over to make his younger brother Chitrangada king, for the third generation, the oldest brother was again passed over. Only this time, there would be consequences for this decision. That's it for now. Next time, we'll see the Kuru princes enter the international marriage market, forming alliances with their neighbors. Also, we'll hear about the birth of both our heroes and our villains, all 105 of them. Thanks for listening. This is the Mahabharata Podcast, Episode 7, The Heroes and the Villains Are Born. Last time, we left off with the birth and childhood of the three Kuru princes, Dhritarashtra, Pandu, and Vidur. Due to the untimely death of their father, and their uncle Bhishma's unwillingness to father children, their uncle Vyasa stepped in and engendered these three boys. This might normally sound like an act of incest, but Satyavati and Bhishma felt it was okay considering the alternatives, and they cited precedents among their ancestors in which Brahmins made love to Kshatriya wives in order to save the race of Kshatriyas. The boys were not without defects, however. Dhritarashtra was born blind, Pandu was an albino, or at least pale, and Vidur was born of a slave, and therefore in a way illegitimate. As the boys came of age, the second brother, Pandu, was crowned king, and Bhishma set about finding wives for his nephews. Starting with the eldest son, Dhritarashtra, Bhishma contracted a marriage with a princess from the kingdom of Gandhara. This was a state to the far northwest of India, in modern-day Pakistan. If you were to look at a map of India at the time of the Mahabharata, you would see that the land of the Kurus, from Hastinapur on the Ganges to Indraprastha on the Yamuna, is pretty much right in the middle of the line of kingdoms stretching from the northwest to southeast along the Himalayan foothills. With the central location and exceptionally fertile lands, the Kurus must have been strategically important players in the international politics of the day. I've put a link to a good map on my website under this episode, so please check it out. The geopolitical aspects of these alliances are not completely clear, but there are clues that more is going on than just egotistical princes fighting over points of honor or greed. This princess from Gandhara was named Gandhari. Her family at first hesitated to marry her to a blind man, but reconsidered because he was the eldest son in a powerful dynasty. It appears to me from this and a few other examples that at the time children were married off in order of age, so the only available son was really Dhritarashtra. Gandhari was the epitome of a good wife. Loyal to the degree that once she was engaged, she refused to even mention other men by name. She even went to the extreme of tying a cloth over her eyes and blinding herself so she would not have any advantage over her husband. Gandhari was a particularly attractive match because after propitiating Rudra Shiva, she had been granted the boon of having 100 sons. With her, the Kuru dynasty need never fear a shortage of heirs to the throne, quite the contrary. Gandhari was delivered to her new husband in the company of her brother, the crown prince of Gandhara, named Shakuni. Shakuni must have enjoyed his welcome, because he was to return many times in the future and cause a lot of trouble. One last point of interest in this marriage was that Shakuni also delivered a large fortune. The Gandharans paid for the honor of an alliance with the Kurus. With Dhritarashtra thus married off, Pandu came next for finding a wife. Pandu must have been more presentable, because he attended the Swayamvara held for Kunti of the Yadus, where she would choose her own husband from the crowd of applicants. Kunti was the daughter of Shura, who was the chief or king of the Yadus. She was then adopted by another king named Kunti Bhoja. The Yadus ruled over the region around Mathura to the south of the Kurus. Kunti Bhoja was a southern neighbor to the Yadus. Thus, the tie with Kunti solidified an alliance with the two kingdoms to the south. Another important thing about Kunti's descent is that her brother, named Vasudeva, will be Krishna's father. So Pandu not only had an alliance with a southern neighbor, he also happened to become the future uncle-in-law of the Lord of Everything. Following this marriage with Kunti, Pandu traveled with Bhishma to another kingdom just west of Hastinapur called Madra. There, they contracted another marriage with the daughter of that king. Her name was Madri. In this case, it was the Kurus who paid out a fortune to arrange for the marriage. Pandu followed up his two marriages with a great campaign against his other neighbors. Having solidified links with kingdoms to the west and south, he followed the Ganges downstream through Kashi, Magadha, Pundra, Videha, and Suma, through modern-day Bihar and West Bengal, defeating them all in battle and subjugating them to the Kuru throne. Having studied Indian history from the early sultanates through the British Raj, I find it interesting how little the politics of India has changed. From ancient times up to independence, the imperial power always seemed to prefer to rule by proxy rather than direct rule. When a kingdom was subjugated, the conquering power preferred to leave the regional prince on their throne and were content to receive tribute and military support in exchange. Thus, even though Pandu and his allies conquered all this region, from the fork in the Ganges Yamuna rivers to the sea, they did not depose the kings of these states. Rather, they demanded large tributes and alliances, and then returned home in glory. Following his massive imperial conquest, Pandu settled down to a life of hunting. He left internal state affairs in the hands of his capable uncle and brothers, and lived with his two wives in constant travel, hunting from forest to forest. Considering that in ancient times, hunting and warfare were almost indistinguishable, there may have been a political aspect to Pandu's travels. I imagine that constantly moving around his conquered territories with a large armed retinue was an effective way of maintaining his hold over these kingdoms. While Pandu was off on his expeditions, his younger brother, Vidur, was eventually married to the illegitimate daughter of a king named Devaka. With her, Vidur had many sons of perfect demeanor who matched him in his virtues. No one is quite sure how these things came about, but just as there are two different stories about Bhishma's incarnation from the Vasus, there are two versions of how Dhritarashtra's wife, Gandhari, got the boon to have 100 sons. I already described the first version, where she propitiated Shiva. The second version is given when we are told of her pregnancy. In this version, she had once comforted Vyasa when he had arrived exhausted with hunger and fatigue. Vyasa then allowed her to make one wish. She asked that she be granted 100 sons. Sometime later, she became pregnant. 9 months passed, and she was still pregnant. In fact, she remained pregnant for 2 full years. It seemed like she might never give birth. In the meantime, she heard about Pandu's wives having one son after another, all while she was still pregnant. So let's cut away from Gandhari and see what happened to Pandu that his wife suddenly produced so many sons. This story begins with Pandu out hunting. While on the chase, he came across a buck while it was mounting a doe. He fired 5 arrows at them in succession and killed them in the act of mating. As they died, he discovered the buck was actually a man. It turned out that a powerful ascetic had disguised himself as a deer and he was out frolicking in the forest when Pandu shot him and his deer partner. As he died, the sadhu cursed Pandu. The ascetic asked him, "How could you do this murder?" Pandu replied that hunting was the way of kings. There was absolutely nothing wrong with him killing a deer. The Brahmin replied that the sin was not in killing him, but that Pandu did it while they were in the act of lovemaking. For that, he cursed Pandu, saying that the next time he should try to make love to his wife, he would die. I find this bit of bestiality interesting. First, in a prior version of this story, given in a summary at the beginning of Book 7, they don't say that the ascetic was in the form of a deer. They just say he was jumping a doe in his human form. Even in this later version, the ascetic describes himself as wearing the guise of a deer and saying that he consorted with does out of his extreme shyness with women. Be that as it may, Pandu, who did not yet have a single child, was now unable to make love to his wives without killing himself in the act. Pandu was extremely sorry for having killed this Brahmin. He thought of his father, Vichi Treveerya, and how he had died childless after following a life in pursuit of pleasure. He decided to follow the path of his natural father, Vyasa, and to forsake his worldly possessions and become a hermit in the forest. The book is not clear on when exactly Pandu gave up the kingship. When he announced his renunciation, he asked his followers to inform the king. That implies that perhaps he had already resigned the crown to his blind older brother when he had retired to the forest. Perhaps he only renounced the crown at this moment. It is not clear to me which. What matters is that, even though Dhritarashtra was disqualified in the line of kingship, he was still the next in line for the throne. So when Pandu was no longer king, the crown automatically went to his older brother. Pandu's two wives, ever loyal, joined him in his austerities, begging food and wandering. Pandu embraced his new identity as an ascetic to such a degree that he became something like an honorary Brahmin, living and traveling among all the other ascetics of the forest. Over time, as he considered his situation, he gradually became desperate about his inability to have children. He cited the law in the Vedas, saying that to fail to have children who will perform offerings to their ancestors is essentially to murder one's ancestors. He nearly became suicidal over this conundrum until a fellow holy man told him that despite his curse, he would nevertheless have a number of fine sons to follow him. In his desperation, Pandu spoke to his wife Kunti, suggesting that she look for a superior man of the Brahmin caste to make her pregnant. Kunti replied with the story of another king who was impotent and who had died. His wife refused to let go of his corpse and mourned his loss and her childlessness for several weeks. Finally, the spirit of her dead husband came back, and through some kind of necrophilia, she was able to conceive. Pandu probably didn't like the implications of this story, so he stuck to his request. At this point, Kunti made a confession. As a young lady living in her adopted father's palace, she had once been host to a powerful sage who, in gratitude, granted her the boon that she could summon any god and conceive a child with him. When Pandu heard this, he was delighted and set her to work right away, saying she should summon the god Dharma and have a child by him. So Kunti recited the spell, and the god Dharma came to her in a yogic form, and she conceived a son. A disembodied voice announced that the child would be a great upholder of Dharma, a celebrated king named Yudhishthira. You might wonder what Dharma was doing still a god when he had already incarnated as the person of Vidur, see episode 6. Well, that's why they call it a partial incarnation. The gods only send down a part of themselves to incarnate as a human. There was still plenty of him left to be both father and partial incarnation of Yudhishthira. Following Yudhishthira's birth, Pandu urged Kunti to use the spell again. This time he asked for a strong child, so Kunti summoned the wind god. This child was to be named Bhima, and he would be immensely strong. At this point, we should go back to Gandhari, Dhritarashtra's wife, who, remember, was also pregnant. She had actually conceived and become pregnant before Kunti used her spell to conceive Yudhishthira. So Gandhari had every reason to think that her son would be the oldest son of the oldest son. In other words, her child should be the first pick for the heir to the Kuru throne. Imagine her frustration when her pregnancy went on over a year and Yudhishthira was born before her child. Her frustration grew even more when she found that Kunti was pregnant with another child. After 2 years of pregnancy, she finally snapped and beat her own belly, causing a miscarriage. What came out was a disgusting ball of flesh. Repulsed, Gandhari made the throat out. Vyasa sensed this and quickly appeared before her. He castigated her, asking her, "What are you doing?" She answered truthfully, saying, "When I heard that Kunti had borne her first son, I became so miserable that I aborted my belly. You promised me 100 sons, and all I got was this mess of flesh." Vyasa replied, "I have never spoken a lie, and so when I said you will have 100 sons, you can be sure you will. Have at once 100 pots set up and filled with ghee, and sprinkle this ball with cold water." As soon as the water came in contact with the flesh, it shattered into 101 pieces, each the size of a thumb joint, and each piece was placed in its own jar. After some time, the pots were broken open one at a time. The first to come out of the pot was named Duryodhana, who was born on the very same day as Pandu's second son, Bhima. This made for a murky situation regarding who was the senior child. Duryodhana had been conceived first, but was born after Yudhishthira. Duryodhana was the eldest son of the eldest son, but Yudhishthira was the son of the senior king. It is precisely around these questions that all the future conflicts were born. Dhritarashtra, probably feeling a bit cheated, summoned Bhishma, Vidur, and his advisors, and declared, Prince Yudhishthira is the eldest son in our line. By his own virtue, he shall obtain the kingdom, and we shall not demur. But shall Duryodhana then become king after him? When Dhritarashtra finished speaking, there was a sudden outcry from all directions of carrion beasts and jackals. Taking this as a bad sign, Vidur said, "Clearly, from these omens, this eldest son of yours will spell the death of the dynasty. You should abandon him at once. You will still have 99 sons, and by sacrificing this one, you will save the world and your dynasty." Vidur ended his speech with an adage, "To save a family, one can sacrifice a son. To save a village, one can sacrifice a family. To save the country, give up a village. To save a soul, give up the earth." Vidur and all the advisors were in agreement with this, but the blind king did not act because he loved his sons. In addition to the oldest son, Duryodhana, Dhritarashtra had 99 more sons and one daughter from these jars. I'll spare you all of their names, because all but a couple play no distinct part in the story. The main sons would be the oldest two, Duryodhana and Dushasana, and one more named Yuyutsu, who was born of a servant girl. Now, back to Pandu, who, as we recall, had his second son, Bhima, born on the same day as Dhritarashtra's first son, Duryodhana. Following Bhima's birth, Pandu asked Kunti to try one more time. This time, he aimed high, deciding to summon the first among the gods, Indra himself. To ensure Indra's cooperation, both he and Kunti spent an entire year in extreme austerity, standing on one foot and facing the sun daily, and barely eating any food at all. Having pleased the Lord Indra, Kunti finally summoned him, and thus was conceived the great hero Arjun. After this great success, Pandu got a little greedy. He started thinking of which god he might call up next, but Kunti stopped him, saying he should be content with these three mighty sons. To ask for more would be improper. At this point, Madri spoke up, saying she would also like to be a mother. Kunti agreed and gave her co-wife the spell so she could also bear a son. Madri, for efficiency's sake, thought to summon the Ashvins, who were twin gods. Thus, she conceived a pair of twins, who would be named Nakula and Sahadeva. Pandu thought to try one more time to round off the bunch, but when he went to Kunti, asking her to allow Madri another turn, Kunti objected. She said, "Madri tricked me by conceiving twins. If I let her do this again, she might have another pair of twins, and therefore have more sons than me." Thus, the five young sons of Pandu, whom we'll call the Pandavas, were raised in the forest with the hermits and ascetics and nature spirits, while the 100 sons of Dhritarashtra, who will be called the Kauravas, were brought up in the palaces of Hastinapur. Thinking back on the Partial Incarnations essay, in which we identified Vidur as an incarnation of Dharma, the case of the Pandavas is more curious. Almost all of the other characters in the Mahabharata are born of human mothers and fathers, but then are sometimes associated with deities as a partial incarnation. The Pandavas are unique in that they are actually conceived by a god on their father's side and have a human for a mother. This idea is very similar to the Greek conception of heroes. Hercules, Achilles, Perseus, and most famously Jesus are just a few examples. So the five Pandavas are both the children of these gods and also their partial incarnations on this earth. These concepts are a little bit murky, however, because later Arjun is paired with Krishna as the reincarnation of the rishis Nar and Narayan. So I'm not sure how this is all worked out, or whether it is completely consistent. While the five Pandavas were still quite young, Pandu was out with his second wife Madri in the forest. This time he wasn't hunting, and his lust overcame him. He forgot all about his curse and made love to his wife, dying in her arms. When Kunti found out what happened, she scolded Madri for allowing her husband to get aroused. She then declared that as the first wife, she would follow Pandu on the funeral pyre. Madri protested, saying that she would not be a fair mother for all five sons, and that she could not live without Pandu. Thus, as Pandu's corpse was burning on the funeral pyre, Madri threw herself on it, immolating herself out of loyalty and attachment to her husband. Following the death of Pandu, an enormous crowd of hermits and ascetics gathered in mourning and escorted the widow and orphans back to the city of Hastinapur, where they could be cared for by their next of kin, King Dhritarashtra. That's it for now. Our five heroes are now orphans, living under the roof of their blind uncle with their ill-fated cousins. In the next episode, we'll hear of their upbringing and education and see how they deal with their jealous cousin, Duryodhana. Thanks for listening.
And that was episodes 6 and 7 of the Mahabharata podcast, available on iTunes. Once again, this show is called The Great Bharat. And good morning to all the listeners who are just tuning in or who didn't hear the intro. So before I go on, I just want to mention that the story is, it can be very hard to follow. There's a lot going on. And if you don't listen to it a couple times, you probably will miss some things. However, there are many different versions or sort of retellings of this story that people have made through the years. And one of them that I would recommend, and I think Lawrence Manzo criticized it at one point, but it is a very good introduction to the story, and that is a film called The Mahabharata by Peter Brooks. Peter Brooks was actually maybe a playwright, but he directed a play about the story, and the play takes place over 2 or 3 nights. So it's actually, it's extremely long, obviously, to cover the breadth of the content. And he was putting that play on for a while. And I guess he ended up making a movie out of it. And the movie is a lot shorter. Obviously, it's about 1.5 hours, I think. I can't quite remember. But you can access that on YouTube. So it's The Mahabharata by Peter Brooks. And it's all in English. It's a very good introduction to the story. It doesn't cover every detail, obviously, but it's it gives you a very good idea, and it kind of puts the characters in your head. You can kind of visualize who the characters are and how it all plays out. So episodes 6 and 7. So the first thing, Lord of the Rings was mentioned in reference to the Gandharvas, and Lawrence basically makes a similarity between the Gandharvas and the elves in Lord of the Rings. Just generally, I think this whole story is very Lord of the Rings-esque. And not only because of the use of archery, which we haven't seen yet in the story, but kind of the main military weapon is the bow and arrow. And so there's all this archery that's going to be going on. And it really, really has the imagery of Lord of the Rings when it comes down to it. But what's interesting, I guess, is, you know, the Mahabharata being thousands of years old and supposedly based on true events. So, you know, it was supposed to be a recounting of events that actually happened. Whereas Lord of the Rings might be based on true events, I'm not sure. But it's definitely not supposed to be, or not intended to be, a true story. It's a work of fiction. The next thing I want to comment on is the concept of Vyasa coming and laying down with the two wives, Ambika and Ambalika. And Lawrence spends a bit of time essentially saying that this is some form of incest. I'm not quite sure myself if that's the case, because what we have here is a man with two wives. So the man is called Vichu Treviria. He gets two wives. These two wives are not related to each other. They're not obviously not related to him. But then he dies before he can they can produce any children. So Vyasa is called in to basically do the deed of producing children. And Lawrence calls it incest. I don't think it's quite, it's not incest, because the two women are not related to anyone. They're just, you know, they're married in. And Vyasa just happens to be the half-brother of their husband. So not incest in my opinion. I found it interesting the names of the three princesses, and the third one being Amba. So their names are Ambika, Ambalika, and Amba. They're kind of all, they're very similar. They're, if you take Ambika and Amba and you combine those, you get Ambalika, in my opinion. But maybe there's something I'm missing. Maybe this is a common thing about Indian culture. I'm not sure. One amusing part, and just the way Lawrence describes it, is when he describes Vyasa coming into the room, and he describes him as a dreadlocked sadhu with skin like moldy beef jerky. And every time I listen to the podcast, I just have to laugh at that point. It's a pretty hilarious description. The one story that was presented is the story of Mandavya. And this, again, is kind of an amusing situation, because Mandavya is an ascetic and who practices a certain yoga where he just holds his arms upraised for long lengths of time, maybe days, and he doesn't speak anything. He just stays like that. So he's doing this one day, and some bandits are being chased by the king's men, and they come in to his hut. They basically run into his hut to hide. So when the king's men come along, they see him with his hands up. Obviously, they might think, okay, yeah, the cops are here. He's got his hands up. That's normal. So then they start questioning him, and he doesn't answer, which kind of irritates them. Then they search his house, find the bandits, immediately conclude that he was hiding them. And so the bandits and himself, they all get sentenced to impaling. Now, because he's an accomplished yogi, he's able to survive the impaling, which is quite amazing. And it kind of makes me think of old kung fu movies or something. But at any rate, he eventually has the stake broken off at both ends, and the king recognizes, you know, this guy's a spiritually very powerful, so he apologizes and all of this. And eventually Mandavya goes to the god Brahma and asks, or sorry, the god Dharma, and, you know, asks him, like, you know, what the hell, man? Like, what did I do, kind of thing? And Dharma, of course, says, well, you know, you impaled an ant when you were a kid with a blade of grass, so you have to suffer like this. Mandavya's response sets a precedent, I think, for future generations, and he basically says, you know, I was a kid, so it shouldn't matter. And that statement in itself stands on such solid ground that he's able to curse the god to becoming a man. And this you'll find all through the story is the theme of someone cursing someone else. And when someone curses someone else, that becomes their destiny. Like, that curse has to come true. There's nothing stopping it. It's a very interesting theme in the story. Another related theme is the theme of taking oaths. So someone will take an oath. They'll proclaim, you know, I swear to do this. I swear to kill this person, or I swear to do this and that. And once they say that, there is nothing stopping nature from producing that effect. They cannot get out of that. Somehow or another, it ends up happening, even if they don't want it to happen afterwards. So another interesting theme. To comment a bit on Gundari. Now, Gundari became the wife of, and this is a hard one to pronounce, Dhritarashtra. Dhritarashtra is one of the sons that was produced by Vyasa. And Gundari is, comes from, I guess, northern area of Pakistan. At any rate, very devoted person. So her husband, Dhritarashtra, is blind. He's born blind. And so therefore, Gundari, as soon as she gets married to him, she puts a blindfold on, and she doesn't ever take that blindfold off for her whole life. Actually, that might not be true. Maybe at the very end of the story, she might take it off. I can't quite remember. But at any rate, extremely devoted person to make yourself blind because your husband is blind. But also the thing about Gundari is that we start to see, and she becomes the mother of the villains in the story. The villains, the eldest son, Duryodhana, I hope I'm pronouncing that right. He is characterized by kind of a jealous, egotistical person. And what's interesting is that we're starting to already see that character come in the form of Gundari. Because this, as the story goes, Pandu's wives start to produce children when Pandu and his wives are living in the forest. And Gundari, at the same rate, she gets pregnant before Pandu's wives. However, because she was granted a wish, or granted the boon of 100 sons, her pregnancy took over 2 years. And so while she's waiting for these babies to come out, her sister-in-laws are having these children. Now, Gundari's husband, Dhritarashtra, is not the king at this point. So he's blind, and because he's blind, he's not the king, although he is the eldest son. So Pandu is the official king. And therefore, the sons of Pandu are entitled, they're basically entitled to the throne. Gundari, on the other hand, somehow she thinks that she's starting to get into her head that if she has a son before Pandu's wives, then there's rights to the throne there. So you start to see some jealousy come into the characters, to the family, and you'll see later on in the story that Dhritarashtra is not like that. He's very kind of passive type of person, kind of a loving father. He mostly gets pushed around by the other characters, like his son. I just thought it's interesting. I noticed this now, is that Gundari is already bringing that character into the story. Another interesting point, Kunti, and Kunti is one of the wives of Pandu. She's the first wife of Pandu. Is her brother, will become Krishna's father. Krishna, of course, in the story, identified as being the supreme god. So Kunti's family actually is very important. Herself bearing three of the heroes in the story, Yudhishthira, Bhima, and Arjuna. And those are arguably the most important of the five brothers, the five Pandavas who are going to come out. But her brother being the father of Krishna, which is, you know, it's quite some important people here. It was mentioned, just to respond to one of Lawrence's comments, the comment about ruling by proxy. So when any of these kings, like when Pandu conquers different lands, he doesn't send his own people in to rule. He keeps the king that's the existing king on the throne, and that king will just basically pay tribute to him. And it's, I don't see it as being very abnormal when you think about more modern colonialism. That's kind of the way it worked. You know, you kind of take states and then they just become kind of they become paying states. They pay tribute to you based on whatever resources they have. Another story introduced. There was a story about the ascetic who was making love to a deer, and this is how Pandu was cursed to die while making love to his own wife. I just think it's kind of interesting that you've got these ascetics and they swear themselves to a life of celibacy, and you know, they're supposed to be the spiritually the highest and most powerful people in the entire kind of culture or world. Yet they always end up having some kind of sexually perverse thing going on. And this is one example where, you know, the one guy, he's making love to a deer, and shamelessly, like, he, you know, for him, it's like, yeah, well, I'm afraid of women because, you know, I'm an ascetic, so I don't see women. So this is normal. It's just, I don't know if it's quite right. The last thing, Kunti's story. Kunti tells a story about a woman who loses her husband, and then she ends up having a son with him. And I thought, is this the story of Isis, Osiris, and Horus from Egyptian mythology? The timing would be about right. Maybe about 1,000 years earlier, this would have been in vogue. Anyway, I just thought that was interesting. So that concludes the show for today. Join me again next week at 11:30 a.m. for the Great Bharat, right here on Sound FM 100.3 CKMS, broadcasting from Uptown Waterloo. And don't forget the Oktoberfest parade is tomorrow morning, so check that out. Okay, we'll leave you at that, and everyone have a good day.